Hello and welcome to the Mariners Library with me, Chris Stanmore-Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book, The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss by Captain J.C. Voss. We're on chapter 5, and this is the fourth part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 5, Arrival at Cocos Island. The first night out, we had another fierce thunderstorm, and in order to get away from this unpleasant coast, we let the Zora go for all she was worth, under the three-reefed mainsail and storm staysail, steering northwestward. By doing so, we soon managed to leave this treacherous weather behind us, and the next day ran into a nice moderate northeasterly trade wind, for which change we were indeed not a bit sorry. Now, hurrah for Cocos Island, only 1,600 miles distant. Not much if you say it quick, and with this nice breeze on our port quarter, we soon ran off 100 miles after another. Both the trade wind and the fine weather kept on just as the doctor ordered them, till the 7th of September. At 3 o'clock, while having an afternoon nap, I was suddenly awakened by a tremendous noise on deck and shouted, "What is the matter with you folks out there? Why can't you keep quiet when an honest man wants to enjoy a rest?" "No time to sleep now," replied Jack. "Cocos Island is in sight, and we must get ready to discharge our ballast and make room for the gold bricks and diamonds." Mac replied, "Yes, old chap, I can see the gold bricks sticking out to the side of the island. Come on deck and have a look." When on a yachting cruise, Mac could never tell the truth if he could replace it by something else. I went, however, up on deck, and sure enough, the island was in sight, but only the tops of the mountains were visible in the distance, about 60 miles away. During the night, the breeze fell light, but the next morning we were up to the east end of the island, and owing to the wind having dropped altogether, anchored in Chatham Bay. Breakfast over, Mac and I took the dinghy and pulled round to Wafer Bay, where the goods we had come for were supposed to be stored. After rounding a sharp rocky promontory, Wafer Bay opened up, and a small house came in sight on the upper end of the right side of the bay. We made for it, and landed a few yards from the building, when, out of the house, stepped a man of rather slim build, and I should say certainly 6 feet 4 inches in height, with a beard hanging down from his chin about 2 feet long. The gentleman was followed by a small, pleasant-looking lady. On reaching us, the gentleman introduced himself as Mr. Geisler, Governor of Cocos Island, and the lady as his wife. "Pleased to meet you, Mr. and Mrs. Geisler," I said. This was not quite 99% of the truth, because I had nourished the hope that we should have the island to ourselves. "Where do you come from?" asked the governor. "Victoria, B.C., I replied. "We made Chatham Bay this morning at daybreak, got becalmed, dropped anchor, and rowed round here in our dinghy." "After the treasure, of course," said Mr. Geisler. "No, not exactly," I said. "We were just on a little pleasure cruise and thought we would come and have a look at the island." "Another one." "Of course, Mr. Geisler," Max said, "if you've got any gold bricks you don't want, we don't mind taking them along." Mrs. Geisler smiled at that and said gold bricks were very scarce on Cocos Island. "Are they?" I said. "I thought you had lots of them here." "Oh yes," replied the governor, "there are lots of them here, but we have yet to find them first." Owing to Mr. Geisler's size and appearance, I considered it advisable to keep on the right side of him. I therefore said, "Mr. Geisler, we have got a few days to spare, so will you allow us to prospect for the treasure, and if we find it, will you allow us to take it on board our vessel?" "You can prospect as much as you like," replied Mr. Geisler, "but of whatever you find, you must give the Costa Rica government 1/3. I could see no way of avoiding this gift of 1/3 to the Costa Rica government, so agreed to the governor's offer. When everything was settled, Mr. Geisler said, "Now, you had better go and bring your vessel round here. And by the way, how big is she?"
10 tons, I said.
10 tons? Well, well, well. And you came all the way from Victoria in a 10-ton vessel? Why, a 10-ton vessel will not hold even a fifth part of the gold that is buried here." After assuring Mr. Geisler that we would probably be satisfied with 10 tons of gold and a ton of diamonds, and let him or the Costa Rica government have the rest, he seemed to be well satisfied, and asked us to come into his house and have a drink. I have never been known to refuse a good thing, so we followed Mr. and Mr. Geisler into the house, and in a little more than 10 minutes, Mrs. Geisler had a table set for us, fit for a king. There was a fine homemade bread and butter, and ham, eggs,
cold roast wild boar, and other things, and notwithstanding the good breakfast we had had just before leaving the vessel, we put that on top of it, and just about cleared up the table. When Mrs. Geisler saw all the empty dishes on the table, she asked if we had plenty of provisions on board. Of course, I knew what she was alluding to, but now let me give the landlubber just a little advice. Never offer a yachtsman anything to eat when he comes on shore, unless you mean it. For a yachtsman, when cruising, is almost always hungry and doesn't know how to say no when anything in the shape of eatables comes his way. "What is the draught of your vessel?" asked Mr. Geisler. "Oh, just about 4 feet," I replied. "Is that all? Well, then you can bring your vessel right up here to my house and tie her up to the trees." He then took me outside to show me where to put the vessel. Right at the head of Wafer Bay is a sandspit about 300 yards deep between the higher land and deep water. It is about half a mile wide, and on both sides there is high land. At high tide, the sandspit is about 3 feet under water, and on the right side, when coming into the bay and within a few yards of the Geisler's house, is a stream coming down from the mountains. Just alongside it is large and deep enough for the Zora to lay comfortably. The stream had washed a hollow through the sandspit, which the governor claims sufficiently large to allow our boat to pass through. I, of course, took his word for it, especially as the man said he had been on the island for 18 years, knew all the ins and outs of the place. The only thing he didn't know, he said, was where the gold was hidden. "We will find that easily enough," Max said. It was then about 10 o'clock, and as Mr. Geisler said it would be high water at noon, Mac and I went back in our dinghy to bring the Zora round, so as to be able to cross the spit at high tide. A nice little breeze had sprung up from the west, and with a small sail set in our dinghy, we were soon alongside the sloop. Jack, in the meantime, had been fishing and was busy frying some of his catch, grumbling all the while that the fish refused to bite. "And how did you catch these fish if they didn't bite?" asked Mac. "I went down and hooked them up," was Jack's reply. "Come along here now and get up the anchor and set sail, and have your growl afterwards," I said. And as my two shipmates were always right on hand when I said the word, we had our anchor up and sail set in no time. With the centreboard down, we beat up against the westerly breeze to Wafer Bay. On rounding the rocky point, we saw Geisler hoisting the Costa Rica flag, which he had informed us would be a sign that the water was high enough for the Zora to cross the sandspit. I at once directed my course for the channel, and everything went fine till we got about halfway across the spit, when she struck a rock, and in less time than I can write it down, the sloop filled with water. We did not even have time to save our provisions, much of which was spoiled by the seawater. The sails were lowered at once, and we tried hard to get the vessel off, but were unable to move her. I felt like shooting the governor, and I think we would have shot him if it had not been for his wife, as all three of us had murder in our hearts. Geisler was standing in front of his house and singing out, "What is the matter?" "Well, come here and see what is the matter," I retorted, after which Geisler came wading through about 3 feet of water to help us get the boat off. We did all we possibly could. Stores, ballast, and everything else we had on board were put on shore, but the Zora remained immovable. She had a rock through her bottom and was full of water. 300 miles from the mainland and stranded on a small island with no steamer or any other means of connection, and nearly all our provisions spoiled with salt water. Truly ours was not an enviable position. Max said he would like to get a gold brick, with which he would knock off Geisler's head. Jack said the only thing he could do was to follow the example of Robinson Crusoe. "You fellows had better stop your fooling," I interrupted. "This is a very serious matter, and we must get the boat off somehow. We had better get several small trees out of the bush, and when it's low water we will try to pry her off." Geisler, after seeing his mistake, helped us in every way he possibly could. "At 3 o'clock, she will be high and dry," he said, and in about 2 hours we had everything ready to raise her. Sure enough, at that time the water was from under her, and a sharp rock could be seen sticking through her bottom. We then got the levers to work, and in about 2 hours had her off the rock, and before night her bottom had been repaired, and she was again afloat, after which we moored her alongside Geisler's house, where she was out of all danger. The governor told us that there were ample eatables, including wild hogs, on the island, and that he would do all that he could to see us right again. We then banished all care from our minds, and after a little celebration and a good night's sleep in Geisler's house, we started briskly early next morning to prospect for the great treasure. Chapter 6. History of the Great Treasure. Where is it hidden? Prospecting and its difficulties. Cocos Island is about 3 miles wide from north to south and 4 miles long from east to west. The shore is composed chiefly of steep, broken cliffs, beyond which is high land. The highest point is of about 3,000 feet. The island is covered with heavy vegetation. Near the water is an ample supply of small, scrubby trees. Being located in the doldrums, there is a very heavy rainfall, and there are several large streams from the mountains emptying themselves into the ocean. The stream in which the Zora was moored was full of fine freshwater trout. The water is very good for drinking purposes, and there's a good supply of edible fish near the land, and it was also a great resort for large sharks. Thousands of seabirds are to be found circling round about that island. Chatham and Wafer Bay are the only two anchorages. The latter, which is on the north side, lies about east and west, and it is on the north side of the bay, along the foot of the hills, that the treasure seekers from different parts of the world have at different times honeycombed the ground. One and all, like Admiral Pallister, left the island without locating the object of their visit. When I looked over the place where the treasure, according to Geisler's idea, was supposed to lay buried, for which seekers from far-off lands have searched in vain, I thought to myself what a time the men would have spent dragging tons upon tons of gold through the heavy vegetation with which the ground was covered. I was told by Hafner how the treasure got there in the first place, and I also saw the chart when in Victoria, with a bearing marked from a small rock about 1 mile to the northwestward of Wafer Bay and leading across the sandspit. It appeared that the treasure was buried on the left side of a bearing from the rock over the sandspit. This strengthened my confidence in Hafner's statement and set me thinking. Mr. Hafner had given me a short explanation of how the treasure got to Cocos Island. Nearly 100 years ago, Peru and Chile were at war. The Chilean troops were victorious, and as Lima, the capital of Peru, was in danger of capitulation, the Peruvian treasure was sewed up in beef hides and for safekeeping was taken on board a British vessel called the Mary Dyer, anchored in the harbour of Callao. The crew of the Mary Dyer plied the Peruvian guards who were left on board to guard the treasure with drink, and when they were thoroughly drunk, got clear of them and sailed away with the vessel and cargo. Now, it was well known that the Mary Dyer had very few provisions on board and would therefore be obliged to call at a neighbouring port to secure the necessary stores to carry on her long voyage. A Peruvian cutter was therefore sent out in search of the pirates. The winds along the Peruvian coast are nearly always from the south, and it was therefore assumed that the vessel had sailed to the northward. The cutter called in at every little port and scoured every inlet along the coast, and after calling at Panama and just as she was getting ready to depart, the Mary Dyer came sailing in. She was met by the cutter outside the harbour and the crew taken prisoners. The Mary Dyer was then searched, but the treasure was not to be found. 8 of the crew, which consisted of 11 all told, were shot. The captain, first mate and a boy were kept prisoners, but on account of the carelessness of the Peruvian officers on the cutter, the captain and mate disappeared during the night. The boy was then the only one left of the crew. He made a statement to the effect that the treasure had been placed on a small island, but did not know the name nor the location of the island. The captain of the cutter came to the conclusion that the only place it could be was Cocos, and the cutter was headed west, and on arrival, the boy at once recognised the island where the treasure had been placed. He also pointed out Wafer Bay as the place where the ingots had been taken in the boats, but as the vessel was kept outside and under sail, and the boy was not allowed to go ashore, he could not point out the actual spot where the treasure had been buried. The island was then searched high and low by the crew of the cutter, but nothing was found, not even traces in the vegetation. That no traces could be discovered in the vegetation so soon after the crew of the Mary Dyer had left the island is almost impossible to believe, and to my mind, the treasure could not have been buried in the position described. Therefore, I believe that Hafner's bearing from the rock leading over the sandspit was right. After looking carefully over the foot of the hills and sandspit, I came to the conclusion that if I had been the captain of the Mary Dyer, I should certainly have buried the treasure in the sandspit, for the following reason. The sandspit is solid sand, and at low water is dry, and at high tide it is submerged to a depth of 3 feet, and it would have been very little trouble to take a boatload of the treasure over the sandspit at high water, dump it overboard, and bury it when the tide was out. Then, in about 6 hours' time, when the first tide washed over the spit, the traces would have been entirely obliterated. The spit, as I have already mentioned, is about 300 yards deep, by about half a mile wide, and being most of the time underwater, tools are necessary to enable one to search for the treasure. But these were not in our possession. I therefore kept my idea to myself, and only inquired of Geisler if the sandspit had ever been searched, to which he replied in the negative. Jack and Mac had the same idea, that if the object of our quest had been hidden at the foot of the hills, it would have been discovered long ago, since all the operations had been centred there. The following morning, Mac took a gun with the intention of exploring the interior of the island and to try his aim on the wild boars. Jack took the dinghy to survey the coast to the westward of Wafer Bay, and I occupied myself that morning walking about the sandspit, shooting and, at the same time, keeping my weather eye open for gold bricks which might be sticking out of the ground. But there was nothing doing. It was nearly noon when Jack returned from his cruise along the coast, smiling all over his face, and in spite of being about half a mile from anybody, whispered into my ear, "I have found the treasure." "The devil you have," I said. "Certainly I have. Come and see," he replied. It was just about midday, and though both of us were very hungry, we did not wait for food. "We must get a boatload before we eat," said Jack. Taking a pick and two shovels, away we went in our dinghy to fetch a boatload of gold. I took the oars and Jack sat in the stern to pilot me to the right spot. When we got outside the bay, we found quite a swell setting in and the surf breaking on the beach with a tremendous roar. "There it is," said Jack, at the same time pointing towards the beach. We had to make a landing, and as I in those days did not know much about taking a boat through a surf, and knowing that Jack had had much more experience in that line, I asked him to take the oars. The dinghy being very small, and both of us a little excited about the good news, it was capsized while Jack and I were changing seats. Both of us were precipitated into the briny and about 200 yards from the shore. Jack told me to swim for the beach, saying, "I'm a better swimmer than you are, so we'll bring the boat back." I thought that by taking my time about it, I would be able to reach the beach, so started to swim for it. I was probably about one third of the way when Jack shouted out, "Look out for sharks!" Knowing that the place was infested with these monsters of the sea, I naturally looked round to see if there were any about. I could not see any, but Jack was sitting astride the bottom of the boat, laughing as if something very funny was going on. I think if I had been a good swimmer, I would have gone back to the boat and had it out with Jack there and then, but being a very poor one, could not even open my mouth for fear of getting a mouthful of salt water. Therefore, I again headed for the shore and succeeded in making a safe landing through the surf, crawling out onto the beach on my hands and knees, more like a drowned rat than a human being. After giving him a piece of my mind with reference to his joking propensities, we proceeded towards the spot which Jack had determined was our goal, and soon reached it. A large, flat-faced sandstone situated in front of a piece of flat land and looking very much like a stone wall had suggested the idea, but this was unfortunately nothing but sandstone. Rainwater running down from the mountains had cracked it in different places, and as the cracks had naturally been filled with sand, the stone ended up looking like an artificial wall. During our stay on the island, we stopped at Geisler's house, and when we returned from our adventurous trip, our friend had a splendid lunch ready for us, to which we did full justice. Mac was still absent. "I suppose," Jack said, "when he comes home tonight, he will have a wild boar yarn to tell about a mile long." "Yes, that may be," I replied, "but it will not make so much trouble for me as your treasure yarn did." I expected Mac back before dark, and should not have been surprised to hear that dead boars were lying all over the country, but he had not returned by dark. There are no trails on Cocos Island, and owing to the very thick vegetation, it is difficult for a stranger to find his way in broad daylight, let alone on a dark night. We concluded that our shipmate was unable to trace his way back again to the camp, and therefore fired several signal shots, but got no answer. We then made a large fire, keeping up a succession of shots meanwhile. Not hearing from Mac by midnight, we were certain that the poor fellow would have to spend that night among the mountains, and as it was raining very hard, it would be very unpleasant. Geisler said in German that he thought the pigs had devoured him. We continued the signals all through the night, but never got an answer from our missing shipmate. At daylight, it was still raining, but about 8 o'clock the weather cleared, and as Mac had not turned up, Mr. Geisler went in search of him. I was almost afraid misfortune had befallen our comrade, as I had heard say that if a wild boar got into a tight corner, it would make a fight. Knowing that Mac would in all probability attack a boar if he got the chance, I was afraid that he had come out second best. About 2 hours after Geisler had left on the search, I heard a double shot right near the house, and looking round, discovered Geisler coming along with Mac, following in his track, looking as pleasant as could be. "Where have you been all night, Mac?" I asked. "I've been hunting," he replied, "and it was the finest hunt I have ever had in my life." "Hunting be hanged," I said. "Why did you not come home last night?" "You would not talk like that if you could see all the wild boars I killed," Mac retorted. Geisler told me that he had found our shipmate sitting on a fallen tree and eating a coconut for his breakfast. I'm quite sure, he added, that Mac could not find his way back here, but would not admit it. Both of them being wet to the skin, they went into the house to change their garments, after which our good little lady, Mrs. Geisler, put lunch on the table, and if ever there was a man that had an appetite, it was Mac. In the early part of the meal, he was too busy to speak, but as his appetite was satisfied, he gradually came round with his boar-hunting stories, and, just as Jack had prophesied, Mac had dead boars all over the island. The old governor was listening attentively, and when Jack or myself remarked that Mac appeared to have a very vivid imagination, Geisler would come to his rescue saying, "No, no, you people don't know this island as well as I do. There are lots of boars here." Of course, the old governor did not know Mac as well as we did, so he backed him up in nearly everything he said until Mac claimed he had shot a boar on the west end of the island, which was as big as a cow. This was too much for the governor, and it made him shake his whiskers about, for he knew that there were no wild animals approaching that size on the island. Mac, as usual, was ready to swear to his statements and offered to take us to see the boar. The distance as the crow flies to the southwest end of the island was about 4 miles, and after allowing for the ups and downs and twists and turns of the mountains, it would be lengthened to about 8 miles. Taking into consideration the moist, heavy undergrowth all over the island and everything else considered, the governor said, "Look here, Mac, before I go to the southwest end of this island to look for proof, I'll see you and your dead boar in Halifax." And that was my opinion as well. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.